Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome to The Mentor, I'm Mark Boris. As health and well-being macro trends continue to gain momentum, the alcohol industry is quickly filling up liquor shelf space with lower calorie drinks. The rise of mindful drinking has taken hold internationally and now Australia is riding exactly the same wave. Hard seltzer is a subtly flavoured alcoholic sparkling water that doesn't taste like it has any alcohol in it at all. Yep, doesn't taste like it's got any booze. In the space of less than 2 years, the category has exploded into the Australian retail landscape, drawing product ranges from big and small names in the local industry and as well as attracting international brands too. Which is why Andy Scorer and Will Morgan couldn't resist getting a piece of that industry with their independently owned Fella brand. Both Will and Andy have global experience working with some of the most iconic beverage brands in the world and met each other while working at an alcohol company, Pernod Ricard. They saw that the premix category was moving towards lower calorie and light fresh trends and created an Australian brand. Fella is expected to hit 500%, yep, 500% growth in the next financial year. Within a year, Fella was available in all of Australia's major chains and independent liquor stores. They've had to move fast and they have to keep up that momentum as more and more want to get in on this seltzer market. So let's get into it. Will and Andy, welcome to The Mentor.
Thanks, mate. Thanks
for having us. Right?
Yeah,
great
good.
I'm getting accents here. Where are you from?
Yeah, I'm from California originally. Yeah. Then moved to New Zealand, did 13 years there, and now I'm in Australia. So
you still got your California. Well, to me, you still got your California accent.
Yeah, I'm from New Zealand originally.
Yeah,
so I moved here about 12 years ago. So
yeah, so none of his Californian accents rubbed off onto you.
Probably a little bit, but no, yeah, I do have a bit of a mixed accent. People say, but
yeah, a little bit, yeah, totally. Mm. And none of his New Zealand accents rubbed off on you.
Well, I don't know. I go home and everyone says I have an accent.
Serious?
And then, yeah, and then when I come here, people are like, "No, you still have a strong American accent."
Totally, from my point of view. Yeah, totally. But it's a good accent. Sounds good.
Yeah.
All right. Okay. So let's just sort of work you two guys out here a little bit. Both from New Zealand at one stage. Why the hell did you go to New Zealand?
I was playing water polo, actually. Came out here, played a season, and then someone over in New Zealand that I knew was like, "Hey, do you want to come play out here?" And league's not that good out there, but I was just traveling the world fresh out of university. Then met my wife, now wife, stayed over there for 13 years.
So, water polo, like we...
I just played it growing up, played Division I in NCAAs, and then there's no pro league after that, so you work your whole life to play this sport and then done with university and you're like, I'm in my prime, want to keep going. And then two options are kind of Europe. The other option was go to Australia. It's not the best league, but it's fun. Still get to play, still competitive.
So who'd you play for?
Played for Wes.
Okay.
Yeah.
My bro, what grade? You play first grade or?
Yeah, first grade.
First grade, yeah.
Yeah.
My brother still plays water polo.
Oh, so really?
He plays for, he played for lots of teams. He played for Cronulla for a while. Then he played for Balmain.
Sharks, yeah.
I'm not sure who he plays for now, but like he's 60-something, so he's still playing. But he's like fourth grade or something like that.
Yeah, yeah.
And all my kids, not all my kids, all his kids and my kids all play water polo together. Yeah, I think they all play for Balmain.
I get hit up to do the social stuff, but I don't want to be that guy that like takes it too
pretty,
serious.
It is pretty fun. Well, it's pretty fun water polo. Like it's an intense game.
Yeah.
Like it was 7 minutes a quarter or something.
Yeah, 8 minutes.
Eight minutes, yeah. It's pretty full on. It's underwater, a lot of shit going on.
I play Sunday basketball league, you know, and you get those guys that take away too serious. And I'm always like, dude, it's social league. So I don't want to be that guy playing water polo. So I'm done.
Well, there's plenty of that. I've been out of the games. There was plenty of those of that guy in those games. I've seen them.
Yeah.
Will, are you a water polo player or?
No, I
never. How'd you guys hook up?
So we were both working at Pernod Ricard.
Who's that again?
So Pernod Ricard is one of the biggest alcohol companies in the world. So based out of France.
Right.
So owns like Jameson, Jacob's Creek, Absolute, and just a
whole bunch. Jacob's Creek, the Australian wine.
Yeah, yeah. So they own a
Champagne
lot of
Moom.
Yeah, Champagne Moom, Stoneleigh. Yeah. So we both worked there. So Andy was in sales, so doing on-premise sales, and I was in marketing and innovation. So yeah, we just kind of were friends there and got talking about opportunities and always spoke about wanting to do our own thing.
Well, there's something in there. Like, so often partnerships get born in business environments or in a sort of a collegiate way.
Mm.
You both found yourselves working at a company that owned a whole lot of alcohol brands in here in Sydney or Australia. And one was in sales and one was in marketing. Well, and how do you get together? Like, because, you know, I know so many people that are working in organisations and they're thinking to themselves, I've got this idea.
Mm.
And they think, I wonder who it is in this place who would like to do this with me. And so how did you go about it? I mean, do you both have a separate idea and sort of claim to each other? Or did you both just become mates first and then work out that you could do something outside?
No, we're mates first. And I think, as you point out, when you're in that corporate environment, you kind of know the people that are going to be corporates for life. And then you kind of know guys that are kind of, I'm here to learn.
And break out.
I don't want to be here for the rest of my life. And that discussion came up with Will and I because we were friends and chatting about it. And, you know, we always wanted to kind of say, like, let's do something, or I don't want to be here forever. I want to start my own thing. And, you know, I'm from the States. Seltzers are massive there. White Claw dominated. It's outselling Bud Light over there. So I kind of knew it from seeing it from the States. And Will was in the innovation team. And what happened? You went over to Europe and they had a whole summit on seltzers over there.
Just saw how, I guess, all the European countries as well were really kind of looking at that space, like RTDs, because RTDs in Australia.
What's an RTD?
Ready to drink, right. So a premix drink. So Australia's got a very mature market with RTDs. They've had it for 20, 30 years, you know, your Jim Beam and Cokes, Jack Daniels and Cokes.
I know.
So you know them well, nice.
When I was 19.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, they've been around forever. So it's one of the top three markets globally. So up there with the US and the UK. Mm-hmm. So globally, it hadn't really taken off. So when we're in Europe, we start to see that all the different companies, all the big brand companies around the world were quite interested in RTDs in that premix space. So seeing that kind of groundswell happening and then seeing what was happening with craft premixes in New Zealand and then also, I guess, in the States, we kind of saw that there was nothing really in market that really tapped into that craft premix space. It was all those kind of heritage brands like Jim Beam, Jack Daniels, and nothing like the craft beer boom that had happened before. So we saw a big opportunity there to do something unique and bring a really kind of authentic Aussie craft beer company through, or craft beverage brand through, to tap into that space.
Mm. Yeah, like, but I always sort of, when I've been down the craft beer thing myself and I was ahead of the market, like I came in too early and more importantly, I got out too early, mainly because it was a punish. We couldn't get in corporate-owned liquor stores.
Yeah.
You had to be at the front of the store. If you got down the back of the store, then to get the front of the store, you had to drop your price, which meant my margin got crushed. And I couldn't sell enough volume to make enough money. And it was just a fucking punish, you know, like excise and bloody this duty and that duty. Like it was a brain fuck, you know.
Yeah.
And so I got in too early, I got out too early. And, you know, and I was walking around trying to work out, because it was like a dream thing for me, you know, have a beer business.
Have a beer brand.
One of those dreams. And then I was always trying to work out, well, who could I do it with? And I didn't work in environments like you guys did, but I've always wondered, like, when do you work out, is this a dude that I can work with? Like, what do you, I mean, do you actually sit down purposely and think to yourself, I can work with this guy? I can work with Andy. Like, he's a
well,
decent
we worked
sort
quite
of,
closely together.
Yeah. Anyway.
Yeah. Well, yeah. At Pernod, we did a lot of collaborative projects. So Will and I launched what was Cocktails on Tap in the on-premise. So we go into venues, we pre-batched espresso martinis, porn star martinis, installed the taps, created the product, and then pushed it out in those ways. So Will took care of the innovation side, working with the producers to actually create the product, create a brand around it, and then my team on the on-premise would go in and sell it in. So Will and I worked together on that, and we always worked really close and worked well together. So I think we already knew that we could work together, communicate well together, and we're on the same wavelength on a lot of things. So when we were kind of chatting about, hey, what are you going to do? Are you always going to stay at Pernod? And we said, no, it's, you know, I want to start my own thing. So do I. And then this whole thing came up of like, fuck, seltzers are booming. Like, so should we do it?
I'm always intrigued by that conversation though. Like, because you think, so, man, I'm going to tell
them.
I'm going to tell him because, you know, like, one, it's an idea and he might knock it off. But two, if I tell him and he's not interested, he might go and tell someone else in the organization and then I'm in the shit.
Yeah.
Who made the first move? Like, were you at a barbecue together or your families and mates?
I think we were just chatting about it. We both saw that the opportunity was coming and we were like, look, I mean, this could really kick off. And I think that's the one thing. You always want to kind of like sound people out first. And, you know, I think we both needed that extra, like that other person to go, yeah, let's do it. And then it's like both of us were like, well, okay, we could do this. Let's, because we're in a big corporate, we would need to jump out of the company first. So there was no chance of doing this project.
You couldn't do a side
by side.
No. Yeah.
We had to go all in and quit our job. So it was a big conversation at first. And then I think I remember the day that we were both like, let's do it. We're going to quit our jobs. And we planned out when we're going to quit. And then we wanted to do right by Pernod because obviously we loved working there and it was a great, great company. So we made sure we kind of really got the project going as soon as we jumped out of the business. And
it's funny, recently someone left one of my organizations. He'd been there for a long time and he was quite a senior person. And I just assumed it was COVID, exhaustion, all that sort of stuff, you know, the great, what do they call it?
The great resignation.
And I thought, wow, it's actually happening. And then I found out he popped up around the corner in a startup, sort of a similar, well, definitely similar industry, but a sort of a similar role. And I thought to myself, wow, he learned a lot out of my organization. Mm. They're not competitors, but nonetheless, I felt a little bit pissed off in the beginning. And then I thought, oh, who cares? But because everyone leaves ultimately. But do those thoughts go through your head? Am I doing the wrong thing by the company? I mean, did you sort of wrestle a little bit with this stuff?
Oh, definitely.
And do you feel like you're like a bit deceitful because you might be thinking about it, like just a little bit?
Yeah, yeah.
Do you feel some pang of conscience?
Yeah, I think you don't want to do wrong by them. We worked there for many years. We're friends with, you know, the MD. We're friends with all the managers, friends with all of our employees. But I think when you have an itch to do something, your soul's not in 100%. You got to go with what you know is right. And we didn't do it, like Will said, we didn't do anything malicious. We didn't do anything like that.
You didn't steal the client list or something?
No. But kept our relationships with them.
How did you do it? Like, tell me about the moment you thought, that's it. On Monday morning, we're going to go in and we're going to both give a resignation.
Well, the liquid courage helped. We were having some beers we said, okay, fuck it, let's do it. And that was the day we did it.
Were you busy in the morning?
No, not in the morning.
We're sitting in the foyer though, weren't we? We were just in the seats and just like, all right, cool. Well, I'll go first. And then, you go like a few weeks later. So
you went and told your respective reports or bosses, whatever you call it. How'd that go?
It went fine. Like, I think they knew that there was a bit of frustration on my end with where I was at in the company and where I was going. I'd had those conversations before. So I think it was just, you know, but it's an interesting conversation because they're like, well, so what are you going to do? It's I'm just off to do some consulting, independent consulting and just spin a yarn. So
More for soft landing than deception, though.
Yes. 100%. Yeah. It's just,
But there's nothing wrong with it either.
No.
It's normal. It happens everywhere. Yeah. And a lot of innovation, initiative and with innovation, comes out of people who work in big organizations because a lot of times the big organizations, they like to be innovative, but they're a bit slow.
Yes.
And it can be a bit frustrating.
Yeah. Yeah.
And fair enough, they don't need to take the risk because they've already got the revenue lines.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas, for me, the way it looks to me is that I'm prepared to take the risk, all the risk. I'm prepared to fuck it up and live by the sword, die by the sword, which they're not. So it's a time for me to go and take it on myself.
Yeah, I think there's always a frustration that those bigger corporates, they always move quite slow. Yeah. So there's just so many hoops to jump through, so many stakeholders, everything like that. So any kind of new innovation, it generally takes a very long time to do. Well, I guess Andy and I knew from, I guess, doing our research that we could actually turn it around pretty quickly and get something out into market, which we knew would have to very quickly because we knew that there was going to be about 40 or 50 following us very closely.
So there was an inspiration.
We kind of saw what was happening in New Zealand. There's this kind of craft premix kind of groundswell happening, and it was really taking a lot of share from beer and wine and everything like that. And then I guess coupled with the seltzer boom that's happening in the States, we kind of saw that this kind of low calorie alternative to beer, alternative to vodka, was really kind of taking off. And because there was that missing gap of craft premixes, there wasn't really anything in market. We knew that there was a market for it. Australia would have the taste for it. So I think it was just, we just saw that gap.
What's the thing about craft? I mean, why all of a sudden, why is there a shift in consumers' behavior?
I think at Pernod, we were kind of, you get a lot of access to data. It's an industry within itself, and these big companies pay a lot of money for that, and it gets presented to them by an agency and things like that. So seeing that and knowing that that data is out there and knowing what the trends are definitely sparked that. But then there's also the aspect of this craft revolution that, I mean, you can't really quantify that, why people want it, but consumer trends, people don't want to have mainstream everyday stuff that everyone has. They want something new. They want something authentic people can relate to. They want to be proud to share it. They want to be proud to drink it. They want to be seen drinking it. Those are the brands that are really growing and thriving in today's industry.
It's very interesting because this morning I heard as parts of the world become more wealthy, Australia being one of them, of course, New Zealand being another one, as we become a more wealthy nation, we spend more money on alcohol in two ways. We have more of it. We consume more of it by volume, but we spend more per volume. Is there some sort of behavioral psychology behind this? Is it about us rewarding ourselves?
People just love sharing new stories, new products with people. If you take a Smirnoff or an established like heritage brand like a Smirnoff to a party, then people are going to be like, they know what it is. It's not unique. People these days, A, they're wanting to spend a little bit more, but they're also wanting to be an expert in, say, a category or bring something new and share a story. And I think that's where, for us, brand building is building that authentic brand that has a really strong story behind it that people get excited about. They believe in it. They can get behind it and then share it with their friends and share the story.
So sharing has a big part of the behavioral change that we're experiencing. We have more platforms to share our stories too.
Yeah. And for us, I mean, we charge a premium for our product. And so we're never going to compete with a Smirnoff or something on price. So what are we going to do to convince someone to pay that extra $2? It's building that affinity to the brand. It's building that connection with a customer that will be like, right, I'll pay an extra $2 because I love the flavor, but I also love what these guys are doing.
How has this demand arisen? Is it because when we are more wealthy or we're just more adventurous? What do you think it is?
I think it's probably the wealth and adventure as well. I think it's a combination. I think probably adventure drives it more because people that aren't wealthy are still adventurous looking for these new products. I mean, the whole alcohol industry has shifted with this craft revolution. You know, it kind of started in beer. Now you've got it in spirits, your low batched spirits, and then you've got wine as well. We noticed that the RTD category didn't have any of that. It was all mainstream, like Will said earlier. You got your Jim Beams, you got your big players, Wild Turkey, but there was none of this like craft experience within the RTD category. And that's where we kind of saw that growing in New Zealand, but nothing in Australia.
I think it's the health and wellness kind of phase as well. That trend's really kind of been kicking off. So again, that's a premiumization trend as well. Well, I'm just like the lower calorie, alcohol type of trend.
Better for you.
Yeah. So I think people are willing to pay a little bit more to feel a little bit better about themselves, to drink a little less sugar, that type of thing. So it's almost like a perfect storm. It's that independent craft revolution mixed with that health and wellness space has created this perfect storm where people are willing to seek out new brands, pay a little bit more for a certain product. So you start in, I guess, your more populated, like more affluent kind of areas that I'm just more around where the brand starts in the center of the cities. And then I guess build out from there. Because we don't have the media budgets to really talk to the whole of Australia, we focus on, I guess, influential pockets that will then seed the brand out authentically from there.
So let's go to the break. We'll come straight back. And we'll talk about this nitty-gritty stuff. How do you make sure it's always the same every time? You know, how do you work these bloody formulas out and get someone to manufacture these things?
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
I'm back here with Andy and Will, and they're from Feller, F-E-R-R-R. Cool name, actually. They called themselves RTDs or something. I don't know what it is. I don't even know what it stands for. But basically, we're talking about alcoholic, seems to be low-calorie mixes, basically booze in a can. But it is a new trend. And I think the very first thing I want to establish is, what is the product, actual product itself in the can, then? Is what is in the can?
So basically a seltzer is alcohol with soda water, and then you mix in flavoring into that. So there's two different types. One is a spirit base, predominantly vodka or neutral grain spirit. But with ours, going back to that craft perspective, we actually wanted to create our own base. So we brew our base in a similar method to beer using rice and corn. We brew that and then we put in yeast. And then that brews for about 3 to 4 weeks, and we come out with a really crisp, dry alcohol base.
Is it clear or colored?
Yeah.
It's a clear base.
Yeah.
So it's quite clean looking.
It's clean
looking. Once you filter it and centrifuge, yeah, it comes out quite clear. Yeah.
Right. Okay. Yep. And then, so, but is it more like a beer than say a vodka or a gin?
It's somewhere in between, almost, because what we do is we actually brew the base up to about 16%. So it's a high alcohol base. Yep. And then we blend it back with the water. So then you get the dilution. So our drinks for the 330 mils are only 4%. So it's one standard drink per can.
Right.
So
it's 4%. Just remind me, in terms of beer, it's a bit higher than that. Is it normally a normal beer?
Yeah.
It's about 5%.
I'd say mid-strength is around about 3.5, and then my normal one's about 4.7 to 5.
So somewhere between mid-strength and a full-strength beer.
Yes.
In terms of alcoholic level. Yeah. But you brew it similar to the way you would brew beer.
Yes.
But it's done with corn and
rice.
Okay.
Yeah.
As opposed to what's beer, hops and something else. What is it?
Yeah. Like a combination of mashes and hops.
Yeah,
and
right.
Everything.
Or gives whiskey, which is barley.
Yeah.
Usually just barley mashed up.
Gives the liquid a bit more viscosity as well than, say, like a distilled vodka.
What's that mean?
A bit more like thickness on the palate, a bit more fuller bodied flavor to it.
Yeah.
While I guess a vodka is, I guess, quite thin. So.
Yeah, that's interesting. Like, beer has a viscosity, as you say.
Exactly, yeah.
It's sort of like it's got a texture that I can
beer
taste.
Beer has a very full mouthfeel.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
Drink that's full mouthfeel.
Is that the bubbles or is it the actual beer itself?
It's actually the beer and the base and everything that's into it. Mm. So it's a combination of everything.
So and it's called a seltzer, but I get what it is now.
Yeah.
Do you guys have to get into, I mean, obviously you got to have to get someone who does the brewing, like a dude, or a cool girl. But is it the person like understand the science of all this? Like, there's science attached to
it. That was the hardest part.
The chemistry.
Trying to figure out how to do it, because no one's actually done this before. I guess it's very different to what the process the guys do in the US. So we had to come up with the whole process ourselves locally. So we worked with a food scientist locally to come up with that fermentation process to create this brew base.
Yeah,
And then finding the right brewer partners who could actually brew. Because it is a different process to beer. It does take a little bit longer. And then finding someone who could scale with us. So we obviously don't have our own brewery at the moment, but we've had to find really good contract partners who could, meet our demand and create the product for us.
Can you just take me through that? Like, so the first thing you have to do is find the food scientists come up with the formula.
Yeah.
Your formula. And the food scientists might hear the brief, the narrative, you know, and then the food scientist comes up with like, because I've just been through this, because I've actually brewed my own whiskey with some guys down in Adelaide called the Bird and Hand Group, one-on-one people. And we're mates. And we decided, let's do a whiskey. I don't know why we did it. We just decided to do it a long time ago. And our first release comes out sometime early next year. The only reason we're not out now before Christmas is because we couldn't get all our bottles and stoppers and stuff because there's a bit of a shortage on things around the world. Yeah. But I've been through the process for whiskey. It's a different process, but it's also brewed like beer in the beginning, just as a bit strong in the alcohol, 60-something percent when it first comes out. But I experienced, by the way, it's not about me, but I experienced tasting tests. So I kept getting these little bottles sent up to me from Adelaide every month.
Yeah.
Saying, you know, which one do you like best? And it might be six little bottles, different colors of the whiskey. They were extraordinarily strong. Mostly all I was tasting was alcohol, but I had to get used to the taste after that period. Then I had to employ experts. Yeah. So, because I got to a point where, fuck, I don't know. None of us knew. They're wine guys. I drink whiskey, but like, you know, I'm just a sort of, you know.
Like the ins and outs.
Yeah, whatever. I mean, I look at Japanese whiskey. I wanted a Japanese style, right? So like the sweeter taste on the palate after, and I don't like smoky, et cetera. So, but then I thought, so I had to go and get experts. So I went and got whiskey judges who judge whiskey and I had to pay them, obviously, to sort of judge the different bottles and give me their opinions. And when they described it, I couldn't understand a fucking thing they wrote, like, you know, chocolate notes and this. That. Yeah. I didn't find any of that stuff. Yeah. But could you explain to me in relation to what you've done here, what is your process? You know, you get the food scientists and there's a tasting process, and then how do you choose what tastes best?
Yeah, we started out, we kind of knew, first of all, how to make the product and concept. We wanted a brewed base, what type of things go into that base. So we approached him, kind of gave him the brief, as you said. He came back with all the samples.
Yep.
And I think he was used to working with guys that weren't in the alcohol industry. So he usually just gives it to him, and we were chatting to him going, hey, this, you know, the acidity is a little high on this. The mouthfeel needs to be a little bit more.
You were saying that.
Yeah, so we were going back and forth speaking to him, and he's going like, shit, these guys actually know what they're talking about. They've kind of done this before. So yeah, it took a long time. So it wasn't just, hey, do this, and then we got something back.
Yeah.
And that was it. And then we brought it to the brewer to make it. We went through multiple samples.
People don't realize that the number of iterations of the tasting and sending it back for, you might change one thing, but that changes everything.
Exactly.
And then you just got to keep doing it and doing and doing. So where would you do this? At home on a Saturday afternoon together
or in your piss by the end of the day?
Yeah. Because we only launched started last year. So this was all done through lockdown of COVID when it first kind of locked down. So again, it would be like getting all the samples shipped up to our apartments. Can't really like leave the apartment. So it'd be like, oh, try it, see how we go. But and then get Andy to kind of run downstairs and just wait outside, pass him out the bottles and that type of thing. So we definitely went through a few iterations, but I think because of our background, and I think that's why our experience previously at Pernod was so helpful, is that we needed to sprint from the outset. From when we decided we were going to start to trying to launch 4 to 5 months later, we had to sprint. So I think we knew what we wanted from a flavor profile. We had a great food scientist who kind of knew what we wanted as well. So it meant that we could move through that iteration process relatively quickly. So I think it was about, only with the flavors, maybe about 5 or 6 versions until we got to the final kind of flavors that we've got here. So, but then it was, I guess, the commercial production after that and getting up to commercial scale was again hard.
Well, that's a big issue. I remember when I was in the beer company, we found it very difficult to get our beer produced. We got all our beer produced in Melbourne. Then we ended up getting it produced in China.
Yeah.
Because it was so much cheaper, and especially when it came to bottling, the bottles, the glass. How did you go about finding someone to brew this? Because, I mean, you know, you got to like brew a lot of this shit. And did you go to a beer brewers, or who'd you go to?
Well, when we first started out, we were just calling people, right? We were like, dude, do you know how to make a seltzer? And they're like, no, what is that? Like, if you don't have a recipe, we're not making anything for you. So we called you know, 20, 30 brewers seeing if they wanted to do it. And everyone just said, no, you have to come to us with the recipe. So got the first step with that. And then we kind of already spoke to these guys about, can you make it? No. Okay. Now that we've got the recipes, you know, sign the NDA. Here's the spec sheet on how to make it. Like, is this something that you can do? And it proved to be quite difficult because the way that we do it is not just brewed in a beer that takes one tank. Then you have to bring it out and put it into a blending tank. Because once you have the base, you got to add the flavoring and the soda water as well. So takes a lot of time, takes 4 weeks to brew, but then you also have to blend it into a blending tank as well. So it can stall, it can slow down, it can speed up, it can do all these different things, but usually around 3 to 4 weeks.
So then you have a tank of
just the base.
Just the base.
Yeah.
And but no, not the flavor.
Not the flavor.
Right.
Then that's when you have to move it into a blending tank.
Yep.
And the base is the same in all these.
Yep.
So then you put it into a blending tank, put the flavoring, some other stuff that we have in there, our secret stuff, and then put the flavoring and sparkling water in.
I'm going to try one of these in a second. So which one do you reckon I should try?
Dry and lime today. Unless you like a bit of watermelon, but the
I'll try the dry and lime. Which one is it? I'm dying to taste it. Okay. Is it going to go everywhere?
No, I don't think so. I didn't check.
Okay.
Oh, is this your first seltzer?
First.
There
ever.
You go.
Oh, nice.
Enjoy.
Can't start with the best, you know?
Okay. Fella. Here's to fella. Wow, that's good. That's also dangerous because I could drink a lot. I can drink that really quick. And it tastes like just a drink. Like a really refreshing
drink. Yeah, it's just super refreshing. Doesn't get you bloated. That one has, like we said, ginger and lime. We really wanted to prioritize the flavor. These things are so delicate. If there's any imperfections in it, because really it's an alcohol base with soda water and flavoring. So it's like cooking an egg. You know, if you mess up on any little part of the egg, it doesn't taste as good. So you need to make sure each aspect of this beverage is spot on and it blends well.
But that's sort of quite subtle, the whole taste. As you say, delicate. I can get all the different. I'm getting better at doing these things, but I'm getting all the different tastes, especially after I've put it down.
And what you find is a lot of them just peer back a lot on that flavor, and they don't put, because they will go no sugar. It's really weak kind of flavoring to it, or you're having to pump it with a lot of artificial sweeteners to give it that kind of full flavor feel. For us, I mean, we've left a tiny fraction of fruit sugars in there to give it that full-bodied flavor while still having only 83 calories per can.
That's equivalent to a pure blonde.
Less calories than a pure blonde.
Not much. It's sort of around the territory, though.
Yeah.
So it's sort of healthy, if you put it that way.
Exactly. The only calories in it are just alcohol.
Alcohol is quite a lot of calories, generally speaking. But that's very good. I mean, I really like the taste. I like the taste of it. I mean, it's quite refreshing. It's a good summer drink.
Yeah.
Totally good summer drink. Does it come in bottles as well as cans, or just a can?
Cans and kegs.
And kegs. Why did you choose cans as opposed to, say, bottles? I mean, is there something behind that?
I think it's just there's a can revolution going on. And I think with premix, it's definitely more of a can. I think it's about 80% can.
Is that right?
Category. So I think for us, I mean, we've also chosen the beer can for a very specific reason as well. I mean, we kind of knew that everyone was going to be copying White Claw and coming into the market at the same time. So for us, we didn't want to do what everyone else was going to do.
What is that?
Using a slimline can, so 330 mil. It's a little bit thinner than these and a little bit taller, but it's what all seltzers use in the States. So I think for us, it was really important to stand apart, do something different. And use a beer style can as well.
What do you do in terms of telling the story about fella? I'm really interested in this because my whiskey is going to be called the bird, as in, so it's a bit of a plain thing, but like telling the story is something we've been grappling with. How do you tell a story about three blokes coming together and just doing something stupid? Producing a whiskey. Aspirations of becoming the best in the world. Like, you know, what the fuck? How do you tell your story? I mean, and what is the story about fella?
We came up with a beer. I think we're at Bondi Tony's down in Bondi, and we're really mulling over what do you name a brand like this passion project that you're doing? And it's really hard to choose a specific name. And what we kind of realized is that a lot of great brands, it's not the name specifically, it's the brand you build around it.
Yeah.
So
and the story around
it. And the story around it, exactly. Yeah. So we heard someone saying, oh, hey fella, how's it going? And it was just a very Aussie way to say hello and hi to one of your buddies. So So we landed on that name. We kind of changed it to an R just to make it a little bit different and audible. But we knew that we didn't want to play on fella because we didn't want to kind of focus on guys with this product.
So you're going to have a bloke walking down the thing, hey, fella?
No, we never play on that.
We're not going to say like get around the fellas or something that. So for us, the key proposition was all around this welcome to a land of fizz, which is what everything was going to fall out from. So a land of fizz is the land, so Australia, the sunburnt country, which is what all our kind of lingual, visual, and tonal cues come from. So everything from our gradients is like from coastal culture, sunsets, everything like that.
Colors?
The colors, sunsets. The name fella, obviously lingual cues from Aussie speech. And then the fizz is really that unique Aussie kind of energy stoke for life that we inject into our comms, our tone of voice, and then even our photography. We use really grainy film, Super 8.
How would you express those things if it comes to advertising?
Yeah, I don't think we have a brand story so much of like we were two guys sitting around and this is the story of fella and created it with this and that. And kind of like, you know how wine labels always have a story on the back and everyone's like, what the fuck is this story?
Yeah,
like,
no,
I don't really care about this. It's more about people interacting with the brand. And we've always said we didn't create a seltzer brand. We created a lifestyle brand. We want people to be able to relate to this in a very authentic way. And what we've done in that sense is we do a lot of our marketing and in terms of experiences with the brand. So we do a lot of pop-ups in bars, in restaurants, festivals. We created our own bar down in the Botanic Gardens where we have monthly music sessions. And people get to experience the brand. That's something that I used to work at Red Bull and that was a big thing that they used to do. They'd never do billboards, but they'd always have experiences. You go to their events, there's girls handing you a can, you interact with that can and you kind of associate good times with that drink. And that's what we kind of want to do with this brand. So it's all about proud to share with your friends, but also having a good time with them. And that's when you reach for fellas, when you're going out with your friends, having a good time.
Do you build a brand Bible?
We are working on one for sure. But I think for us, it's really about cutting through, I guess. You know, a lot of the big brands, they always just do the same stuff. You know, they might just post a photo of, you know, Byron Bay or just get an influencer who's really just posted about 10 or 15 other brands in the last like week to push their product. And I think it's going back to building that authentic story and really building brand love with like a customer. It's just like doing something that they relate to, that they can really get behind and sell your story for them. Because if you've got a brand that they really relate to, that they're passionate about, that aligns with their values, and then you've got a liquid that they love, you've instantly got a viral product that they're going to go tell their friends and then they're going to tell their friends. And I think from a small base for two guys just trying to get a brand up and running, that's far more valuable than, you know, $10 million on an advertising campaign trying to push something that they've seen a million times.
So you launched, when did you launch?
Sold our first can July last year.
In the middle of the pandemic.
Right in the middle of it.
And so you've sort of been kicking along for a year and a bit now.
Yeah.
Are you collecting data as to people's experiences? Are they sort of coming along for the ride like you've expressed in terms of
just
the brand?
Drive down the beaches in Sydney and just see the picnics there. So
serious?
Yeah. 100%.
Yeah. I haven't been out enough because I've been locked up. But yeah, I'm not joking. Is that the case?
Yep.
Yeah. People are drinking these on the beaches and stuff.
Absolutely.
So where's your demo? Like, is it in you said people, but is it young people in Bondi or is it families at Nielsen Park or Mendeley? I think
it's a big mix now. Yeah. When we first started out, you obviously kind of create your business plan and your target market and you go out and you pitch that. But it's changed a lot. We thought originally it was going to be 20 to
25.
You know, it's like that's it. But now that we've seen it, it's this. One, the brand, but two, this better for you drinks, people from all ages, all walks of life. You know, you got your tradies that are walking around, these big burly dudes, and they're drinking a pink can of fella, and you see them drinking pink jugs at the bar, and it's a big mix now. And I think it's testament to the brand as well. People kind of buy into it, but like Will said earlier, there's very saturated category at the moment. So there's plenty of options for them to choose from. So
yeah, because you've got to cut through, haven't you? I mean, it is saturated.
Yeah.
How do you cut through? I mean, or don't worry about cutting through? I mean,
you've got to cut through. I think we kind of saw that, you know, anyone who has went into this thinking that there wasn't going to be 50 brands following suit in the first year went in very blind. And we kind of knew that everyone was going to come in, throw stuff against the wall, figure out what sticks. So year one was always going to be a bit of a trial, like see what, you know, what flavors people likes, what brands resonate, that type of thing. So a lot of the big brands have really changed their tact. A lot of them have fallen off and disappeared. We've always had a very clear strategy. We've known where we've wanted to go. We've known what brand we wanted to create, what liquid we wanted to go with. So again, we've been able to sprint from the start. So again, that was super important. And then just knowing that everyone was going to copy White Claw. So you've got about 10 like white cans, slimline, tall cans, round logo, some kind of obscure wave reference sitting next to each other. And you're all kind of claiming, oh, I'm low sugar or I'm 83 calories. If you're all doing the same thing, then you're not standing out.
There's no point claiming.
Exactly. So we've made it very small in our can. And for us, that's why we say we didn't want to create a product. We wanted to create a lifestyle brand. So around this fella product. So that really helps us, I guess, connect more authentically with Aussie culture, Aussie youth, and then build that kind of authentic brand that people will tell the story about.
And is the Aussie piece, I mean, obviously it would appeal to Australians to buy it, but is the Aussie piece also something you're playing on because people in America, for example, love Aussie stuff? A lot of people around the world, like, are you looking at exporting it to other countries because of the Aussie-ness of it, or are you just looking at Australia?
I don't think originally that's what we thought, but it's definitely has its advantages. I think Australian, New Zealand-made products are viewed as premium around the world, and so we kind of already fit into that demographic being premium as well. So I think it'll have its advantages, yeah.
And clean and good provenance. Yeah. And, you know, there wasn't an arsenic pit next to where the thing was brewed. And, like, you know we're not going to get poisoned blueberries or something.
Yeah.
I mean, there was no motive behind it in terms of just going with this. It was just more of an authentic. We wanted to build the brand that we love to live every day.
You know, it's really funny. You just said you've got a couple of guys that come from another place and they come to Australia and they've been here for a number of years and there's some things that they really appreciate that they think are pretty cool about Australia. And it takes a couple of foreigners to start to, we all take for granted.
Yeah.
And what you're doing is you're actually picking it out and you're reselling it back to us. and because, you know, as you say, we take for granted, but once you talk about it, it is important.
Oh, definitely.
How did COVID affect you? The COVID lockdowns, all that stuff.
It affected us. Well, we were going to start in the on-premise. So we were about to put all this damn liquid into kegs and go, let's really shake this up. Let's be the first seltzer on tap and not even worry about cans and build the brand in the on-premise because people get to experience it. You're going out, you know, you're having a good time with your mates in these really cool pubs. You get to be associated with those pubs, use their name to build your brand as well. And then COVID hit and we went, shit, we've got to stick this stuff into cans now. And you can imagine trying to sell in a new category and a new product into retailers that have no idea what a seltzer is, let alone your brand. So you can imagine trying to sell something in like that is super hard. So we got it into some independent shops, some bottle shops, but then it was the whole, how do we get people to buy it? Because one, usually with a new brand or a new category, you're doing tastings. So you walk into an independent shop. Hey, Mark, why don't you try? Have you tried a seltzer? No, try this. It's fella. Can't even do that. You know, like 101 basic. It was quite nerve wracking. We started it. We've got all this product and now we've got to kind of call people because you weren't even allowed to go into the bottle shops really and be like, can I taste it with you? The bottle shops were like, dude, we're not taking reps in. So yeah, it was a slow burn at the beginning.
Okay, so you're right. With the little experience I have in this, if you can't be in there doing a taste test, and you know, obviously didn't have the budget to start off with to, you know, advertise the shit out of it on television or whatever or wherever everybody's watching, if your price is not right and you're not the thing that everybody's already buying, you're not going to be up the front of the shop, the bottle shop. You're going to be at the liquor store. You're going to be down a little bit further down because everyone fights for position in the liquor store. How did people start tasting you? Like, I mean, how
that's
did that
a
work?
Weird thing, eh? Like, you have this like dream of like starting a business and like getting out, selling it, going, chatting to people, and then you're on your computer in your apartment, locked down, just like, people drinking this yet? Like, and then you kind of realize that first moment when you know that your friends have stopped or it's gone beyond your friend group and that type of thing is when you kind of really get excited and that type of thing. But again, the brand had to stand on its own two legs. Yeah. So if someone was going to see it and try it, then tell their friends about it, then, you know, it had to do that job itself. So
but
I think
if I
that's
walked
where,
in the store, sorry to interrupt, but if I walked in the store and I saw it there,
yeah,
I don't know what it is, so I'm not going to buy it. And then you know, the dude at the counter, he's not going to sell me. I probably wouldn't even ask. But how did you get me to?
Well, we pushed our socials, so yeah, that kind of got a little bit of the story out. And we started in Bondi. That's where kind of we sold to some guys that we knew in the bottle shops there, helped us out, took a chance on us, put us on the shelf, told all of our friends about it. We gave some product away to some people that we wanted to work with. We don't really do kind of influencers, but we work with artists a lot. So giving the product to them, chatting to them. And yeah, eventually, you know, the seltzer category started picking up momentum and people started talking about it. And then White Claw announced that they were going to come. And now all of a sudden people were kind of new of the seltzer category. But we also did in-store visibility, putting up posters, putting up wobblers, just all the standard stuff. And luckily the can stuck out on shelf and people started kind of drinking. And then we just blew up in Bondi because that's where Will and I were based. And those are the only bottle shops that we could get into. And yeah, it's grown fast over the year and it's been awesome.
In terms of distribution, how do you distribute your product?
Well, we use a lot of wholesalers, so wholesale business. We're in the likes of ALM, ILG, those guys, and they distribute to independent bottle shops. And then we're also in Woolies, which is Dan Murphy's BWS, and Coles.
How'd you get into Dan Murphy's? What's the process of getting them to stock your product when everyone's trying to get there?
Yeah. Well, they've got a category manager, and he's the gatekeeper. So right. This guy... For all Dan Murphy's and BWS, there's one dude that makes a decision for a category. So the RTD category.
Right.
Then they've got one for beer and wine and spirits. So this guy is the gatekeeper. You need to get him to look at your brand, believe in what you're doing. Also commercials as well. But a lot of it's, you know, do these guys actually know what they're going to be doing? So you pitch to them. Brand, you taste it with them, and then they go, okay, well, we want X amount of margin. And you go, you fucking kidding.
Yeah, out of the price.
Yeah.
And you recommend a retail price. Yeah.
So, it's
a lot.
Combination of things. And that's, again, the first time we had our first meeting with them was right before lockdown. Mm-hmm. Seltzer category was pretty much non-existent. So these guys were like, we're only going to put one of these things on shelf. Now they've got, you know, two bays of it. 30, 40 products in each store. It's just negotiating with them. Once they believe in the brand, they like the taste, it's negotiation on price and then with the distribution within their stores.
Because once you get with them, they're everywhere. I mean, they're by far, Coles and Woolies are by far the biggest. Well, they sort of do your marketing for you because they're basically marketing organizations who charge you a fee for shelf space.
Exactly.
Yeah. That's how they operate.
Yeah. It's real estate, right?
Yeah, it's real estate. Yeah.
And you know what? When we first did it, we got knocked back at first. They said, look, we're taking one or two seltzers. We're going to go with the big guys because they obviously give them a lot of money and marketing funds and everything else. And then they called us back and they went, hey, we're going to start this local program. We'll give you X amount of stores. We'll test it out, see how you guys go. And then we jumped onto that and it moved extremely well. We had the number one rate of sale seltzer kind of in the stores that we were in. And we've slowly built our distribution, which was kind of a blessing in disguise because you jump up, you need more cash flow.
Yeah,
and we needed to raise more money. So Will and I still, we did a small raise with friends and family. But other than that, we haven't brought on any external investments. So
where to from here?
Build out a little bit. I think that's like, so Woolies and Coles, obviously for us, because it was just two of us in the whole business, that's the easiest route to get broad distribution because you're talking to one person who has access to all those stores. So I think at first, like that's why we kind of went for those kind of channels. The independent channel is huge. It's about, you know, 8,000 to 10,000 stores of individual store owners around Australia. The problem with that is you actually need to go pretty much knock on every single door. So for a small brand trying to get into the kind of banner group core rangings, you need to have about 80% of the ranging anyway. So not having a sales team ourselves and not being able to go out and knock on every single door, we went down the national account routes. But now I think we've still got, you know, 10% ranging in those. We can still grow in those areas. But this independent area is where our focus is now. So we're obviously got a sales team that we're onboarding now, which is great. Some awesome guys had just started, and that's kind of where we see the growth of the business for this year as well.
It's interesting. Timing is such an important thing. Mm. I mean, your timing, I could call it impeccable, but I could also call it sort of synchronistic too, because, and sometimes it requires both. I mean, we had COVID, people locked down, people were more interested in looking up different things, tried different things. You know, people are more curious, much more adventurous. People also aware of trends overseas for some reason. You know, we all checked out certain things. And then here you guys are launching sort of pretty early doors. Mm-hmm. But off the back of your own experiences though at Pirno.
Yeah, I would not want to be coming into the space now.
Yeah.
You know, it's already diluted. It's super saturated. It's yeah, I don't think that people will be wanting to put more seltzers on their shelf space.
A lot of things have definitely gone our way. So we've been relatively lucky, especially just being two guys up against, you know, your Smirnoffs. Like every single big beer company, spirits company, anyone who's sold a alcohol venture in the last 3 years has thrown their hat in the ring. So we're up against everyone, and it's just been the two of us. So we're excited now to bring on a team finally to start helping out, because we've both had newborns as well in our first year of business. And yeah, so time's definitely been stretched out. And
well, but it takes me back to right to the very beginning, to be honest with you, when we talk about timing, and it's not luck, but you two guys made a decision at the right time. If not for that moment where you both we're having a beer one day and you both decide, okay, well, I'm going to do it, and you go 2 weeks later.
Yeah.
If not for that moment, you might have delayed another year and COVID could have hit, and you goes, oh shit, there's no point doing it now. Let's just ride it out a little bit. We're with a big company getting paid wages. Let's just be careful. And then you could have missed the boat completely.
Yeah.
Do you reflect on that?
Oh, I've wanted to start so many things, right? I used to run my own business and then jumped into this. And, you know, I see trends like, I'm from California. I was like, fuck, I want to start a Mexican food restaurant, you know, kind of like, and then all of a sudden there's Mad Mex, Embrero, all these things. And then, you know, there's a frozen yogurt thing that I was looking at. And then you just see these people do it and you kind of go, fuck, I should have just done it.
Yeah.
So I think I got to that point where I always knew I wanted to jump back and work for myself and do something. And like Will said, I think it's easier when you have someone doing it with you, because it kind of, you get to share that load, you get to share that stress and catch up and make sure everything's going
well.
You
get affirmation too.
Yeah. I was quite lucky. I think I found out 3 weeks after I quit my job that I was having my first child. And I was just like, so I feel like if I had delayed it and I found that out, then, you know, you'd run it in your mind, like, should I stay in a more, you know, safe, you know, corporate job, you know, really kind of take the paycheck, or still probably would have gone for it. But I mean, it just makes you think.
What would you say about that moment when you think it's time, I've got to do this?
Yeah.
I mean, we just fully did our research. So I think, and what I say is that we always kind of, we worked to our unfair advantage. So we had such a broad range of experience. So Andy in sales and me in kind of marketing and innovation. So we kind of had the base level of like experience. We knew we could do this and we knew we could do it very fast. So I think it was just, and I've wanted to do like brands before and I just never really took that jump. I think we kind of got all our ducks in a row. We kind of knew that we could potentially do this, get it working. And then it was just that leap and I think that's where what Andy said, you know, having both of us being like there together in the same boat, being like, yeah, let's do this, really helped. Cause I think if I've always looked at doing stuff myself and I've never really taken that leap because it was just all on me and I just never made myself make that leap. And I think that's where having Andy there was, you know, that extra support and having someone there along for the ride was really important.
But why not? You know, it's like I was in a corporate job. I did like it, but if it didn't work, you just go back, right?
It's funny you just said that. Some people ask why, some people say why not.
Yeah.
And I'm a big believer in partnership too, like what you've done. I mean, I just think it's much more powerful in your own mind.
Yeah.
It's probably not that much more power, but it is much more powerful because you just believe in yourself a lot more. You end up having belief in the idea, the business. And then when one's down, the other one picks you up and vice versa, et cetera, and you can sort of ride through it better. Quickly ask you, I'll offer to you, do you have a question for me? Do you have any questions you want to ask me?
Obviously, there's just been two of us in the business. So we're now looking to start building out our kind of advisors and that type of thing and build out, a strong board eventually.
Yeah. I think that's a really good point you just made, by the way, advisory board. I don't think you need to have people on your board. As soon as you start asking people, could you join my board, they get nervous because all of a sudden they become responsible as directors. you got to work out, how do I find somebody who is like-minded, will challenge me in things that I'm good at, and also be adjunctive to things that I'm not good at, and put them on a side environment. You don't, because unfortunately, sometimes you can get these individuals who then want to try and run the business for you. And that's not what you fucking want. That is a punish. That is a total punish. And or they get so nervous outside, when they're not on just an advisory board, but they're on a board, or they have some sort of official role, they get so nervous that everything they tell you is always guarded and around, sort of sits around compliance. And that's what leads them. You want freewheeling, free-thinking, experienced, adventurous individuals who are doing it there if you can, because they absolutely love it.
Yeah, and I'll shoot straight with you, huh?
Yeah, no shit, no, just straight into it, and not there for the lifestyle.
Yeah,
you know, not there because they get a pallet of fucking free booze every month or something like that. You know what I mean? Like, I know I'm exaggerating, but yeah, but that's how I tend to form my advisory groups. But most important, I think you said a really important thing, they tell you straight. They don't fuck around.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a tricky thing to do. I've been on strategic advisory boards where dads have asked me to go on a strategic advisory board for their kids who are running businesses. I used to do it. And I found the dads used to tend to get in my ear. And they were actually using me to try and control the kids.
Talk to them.
And then I resigned. There shouldn't be any affiliation.
Definitely.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah.
Well, guys, that was fantastic. I really enjoyed
your brew. So, yeah, enjoy.
I love the name, fella. I mean, it's an old school name. I mean, yeah. I got friends, older friends, who would say to me, hey, fella, that's how they used to talk to us.
Yeah.
It is very Aussie. I don't hear it that much these days, but I certainly used to hear it a lot when I was a kid.
It's
made a comeback. Right here.
It's made a comeback.
There it is, right there.
There you go.
I'm going to have another crack at this.
Yeah, give it a go.
And so it's on tap as well, so it's been a big push for us. So
it's very good. I really like that taste. Thanks, guys.
Awesome. Thanks for having us.
Thanks for listening to The Mentor. Audio and production is by Jess Morley. And production assistants, Jonathan Leondis.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Summer's just around the corner, so give your body the care it deserves with Osea's best-selling Andaria Algae Body Oil. Created by infusing Andaria seaweed in barrels of botanical oils, it leaves skin silky soft and glowing. Plus, it's clinically proven to improve elasticity and deeply moisturize without feeling greasy. It's safe, clean, vegan skincare. Get 10% off your first order at oseamalibu.com with code GLOW, plus free shipping on orders over $60.